The scene outside the south entrance to the summit hall was chaotic, with mobs of onlookers and security personnel milling about, and media reporters jostling for close-ups with their holocams and recorders. Cordons of body-armored police fought to keep the masses from pressing too close, as vehicles ranging from the most primitive to the most luxurious conveyed delegates to the porte-cochere that hooded the entrance. Judicials circulated through the crowd, trying not to be obvious, despite the communicator beads in their ears and the sophisticated comlinks on their wrists, while Jedi Knights, with their brown cloaks and belt-mounted lightsabers, made themselves all too obvious.
"I don't see a hope of getting inside," Boyne said to Cole, at the leading edge of the crowd. "Even if we managed to reach the door, we'd never be able to slip any hardware past the weapons scanners."
The two of them were wearing loose-fitting robes, sandals, and turbans that concealed their head wounds. Cole had found himself an actual crutch made of a lightweight alloy, but he was weaker than when he and the Rodian had made their hasty departure from the customs warehouse. Both were surviving on bacta patches and periodic injections of pain blockers. "Let's have a look at some of the other entrances," he said. They began a clockwise zigzag around the grounds. The west and north entrances were no less crowded or confused, but the east entrance wasn't nearly as mobbed or as well guarded. Waiting to be admitted were administrative aides and freelance translators, protocol and service droids, an ensemble of drummers and trumpeters sporting tall helmets and garish uniforms, and mixed species groups representing the Rights of Sentience League and the Association of Free Trade Worlds, among others.
"Strictly second-tier attendees," Boyne remarked.
"Our kind of folk," Cole nodded with his chin, indicating that they should saunter down the long line. Partway along, announcing themselves with a colorful banner, waited 100 or so veterans of the Stark hyperspace conflict. A brief, though bloody, conflict that had erupted 12 years earlier, it had been fought largely on worlds where bacta was scarce or too expensive. Consequently, many of the veterans, human and alien alike, still showed gruesome scars, patches of horribly puckered or wrinkled flesh, and missing limbs or tails. Paralyzed as a result of disruptor fire or electromagnetic detonations, a few were confined to repulsor-lift chairs and sleds. It was the latter group that caught Cole's attention.
"I think we found our way inside," he told Boyne.
Centered in the 180-degree arc of tiered seats that separated the Coruscant delegation from the Trade Federation Directorate, Senator Palpatine sat with Sate Pestage, Kinman Doriana, and others in the section designated for the Naboo system. Palpatine had angled himself to the left in order to watch the seven members of the Trade Federation Directorate assume their seats. Flanking the four humans, the Celestan, the Gand, and the Nemoidian, contingents of security droids stood with blaster rifles affixed to their squarish backpacks, like skeletal sentinels of death. Palpatine was so engrossed that he failed to observe the approach of Senator Ornfree Tah, despite the fact that the bloated Rutian Twi'lek had arrived by means of a repulsor lift chair, with his retinue of attachés and aides trailing behind him like servants.
"An impressive showing," Tah said to Palpatine, glancing around the resplendent hall as he lowered his chair to the floor.
"Assuredly," Palpatine said in a distracted way.
Tah regarded Palpatine for a long moment.
"Senator, permit me to say that you seem somewhat preoccupied."
Palpatine finally swiveled in his chair to face Tah.
"In point of fact, I have just received some rather distressing news from my home system. It seems that Naboo's King Varuna has abdicated the throne."
Tar's massive headtails twitched.
"I must confess, Senator, that I don't know whether to feel sorry or glad for you. But where exactly does this leave you, in any case? Is there some danger of your being recalled?"
"That remains to be seen," Palpatine said. "Naboo will have an acting regent until elections are held."
"Who is in the running to replace Varuna?"
"That, too, remains to be seen."
"Dare I inquire as to your hope?"
Before Palpatine could respond, a swell of agitation began to sweep through the hall. To all sides, heads were turning toward the south entrance. Shortly, Supreme Chancellor Valorum and the rest of the Coruscant delegation appeared. The hall responded with extended, if merely cordial, applause.
"He arrives," Tah said, as Valorum was being escorted to his seat. "But who is that with him? I recognize the sector governor,
but not the lean and hungry-looking one beside him.
Lieutenant Governor Tarkin, Palpatine replied, while clapping his hands.
Ah, yes, Tarkin. A bit of a throwback, isn't he? Very militant and authoritarian.
Power can turn even the meekest of bureaucrats into a raging manka cat.
Just so, just so. And speaking of that, Senator,
Tar added in a conspiratorial tone,
do you recall the information I brought to your attention a while back regarding Valorum family holdings here on Eriadu?
Vaguely. Something about a shipping company, wasn't it?
Tar nodded. As you know, many small concerns are poised to see their market status considerably advanced as a result of Valoran's taxation proposal, and also as a consequence of investments from core worlds like Raltir and Kuat, who are ever on the alert for opportunities.
What does all that have to do with Valorum's holdings? Palpatine asked mildly.
It appears that said shipping company has recently received a significant inflow of capital, and yet the Supreme Chancellor failed to inform appropriate parties in the Senate. Naturally, I began to wonder if he was even aware that someone had invested so heavily in the family business, and just who it was that had invested.
It wouldn't be like Supreme Chancellor Valorum to conceal something of that nature.
Initially, I believed the same. My assumption was that if it could be determined that the funds had indeed come from investment speculators who had no direct ties to Valorum, then, despite all outward appearances, no breach of protocol or propriety had occurred. But when I endeavored to establish as much, I kept finding myself beset with obstacles, dead ends, and ambiguous leads. As you yourself suggested, I resorted to turning the matter over to Senator Antilles, who has the necessary leverage to pry into those areas to which I was denied.
Has Senator Antilles made any progress?
Tar lowered his voice a notch. What I have to tell you is hardly equivalent to your revelation about King Varuna. But, in fact, I have just learned that Antilles was successful in tracing the origin of the funds to what he at first thought was a venture capital consortium, but which, in fact, appears to be a fraudulent bank account set up expressly for channeling illicitly gained funds to areas of special interest.
Palpatine stared at him. By special interests, I assume you refer to those senators who are receiving kickbacks from various organizations, criminal and otherwise.
Precisely.
But you have yet to learn where the funds originated.
We are getting close, and the closer we get, the more potentially embarrassing this could be for the Supreme Chancellor.
I'd appreciate being kept fully informed. Tar smiled.
We'll make no announcement without consulting you.
Palpatine and Tar turned to watch Valorum waving to the crowd, which responded with a second round of gracious applause. This is the Supreme Chancellor's moment, Palpatine said. We shouldn't spoil it with gossip.
Tar was chagrined. Please accept my apologies, Senator. It was never my intention to spoil the moment.
He glanced to his left.
I'll leave that to the Trade Federation.
Viceroy Newt Gunray felt as if everyone's eyes were on him, despite the fact that it was Valorum who had the hall's undivided attention. Gunray's own eyes, however, were on the battle droid that had been delivered into his care only moments before he and the members of the Directorate had left their temporary quarters for the summit. Indistinguishable from the dozen other droids providing protection for the Directorate, save for a blush of yellow markings, the new addition stood just to Gunray's right, at the leading edge of the detachment on that side of the Trade Federation rostrum. Gunray had barely had time to settle into his quarters on Eriadu when the Sith Lord, faithful to his word, had appeared by means of the holoprojector Sidious had sent him months earlier.
Some strangers will be coming to give you an additional droid, Sidious had said. A battle droid. You are not to question them, nor the purpose of the droid itself. You will simply instruct the droid to join the others you brought to Eriadu. It will respond to your commands.
It was the second of the Sith Lord's directives that continued to prey on Gunray's thoughts, in any case, and was the cause of his present disquiet.
Even now he saw that the ensemble of musicians were assembling on the floor in preparation of trumpeting the fanfares that would inaugurate the summit. It was only a matter of minutes. Gunray made note of where Lock Dodd was seated. Discreetly, he mopped away some of the perspiration that beaded his face, and he tried to calm himself. Mostly, however, he counted down the minutes in silence. From the padded seat of a repulsor lift chair Boyney had helped him commandeer from an oblivious veteran of the Stark hyperspace conflict, Cole gazed across the summit hall to where the Trade Federation delegation had an area to itself, opposite Supreme Chancellor Valorum and the Coruscant Bunch. His vision was unfocused and narrowed to a tunnel, and his body was racked with pain, despite the injections Boyney had been administering with increasing frequency. The Rhodian stood behind Cole, training a small pair of electro-binoculars on the Trade Federation's complement of 13 droids.
"Only one of them is missing a restraining bolt," Boyney said, close to Cole's left ear. "The droid with the yellow blazes on its head and midsection. Just to the Nemoidian's right, at the head of the line on that side of the rostrum."
Cole put the electro-binoculars to his eyes. "I've got him," he said weakly. Then he began to scan the immense hall with the glasses. "Havoc's somewhere in here. Probably with a remote control in hand." Boyney glanced around.
"It's possible that the droid has been programmed to respond to a certain event, or at a specific time. But even if Havoc has a remote, it won't necessarily have to operate by line of sight. He could be anywhere in the hall, or outside it."
Cole shook his head. "Havoc's the type who needs to watch this happen. He planned it. It's his show."
Boyney's gaze continued to wander over the tiers of seats. "He can't be in the delegate section, and I doubt he plays the trumpet."
Abruptly, Cole looked over his shoulder at the Rhodian. "What was Havoc before he turned to terrorism, Boyney? Before he joined the Nebula Front?" Boyney thought about it.
"Some kind of holomaker, right?
A documentary holomaker. A freelance media correspondent." In concert, they raised their eyes to the media booths high overhead. Fresh from the rooftop chase, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan joined Sacy Tien and Adi Gallia on the floor of the hall, just inside the north entrance. Valorum was seated to the right and above them, the Trade Federation Directorate to the left. In front of them, the members of the Eriadu delegation were taking their places in the stands that had been erected in the center of the hall. Below the stands, a group of drummers and trumpeters were tuning their instruments. The air was charged with excitement. "The six we captured maintain that they've never heard of Cole or Havoc," Qui-Gon explained to the other Jedi, "and that they don't know anything about an assassination attempt."
"Then what were they doing on the roof, armed and dangerous, and firing on you with a rocket launcher?"
Adi Gallia asked. "They claimed to be a band of thieves who thought they could take advantage of the disorder surrounding the summit by breaking into the Sesuena Sector Bank."
"Did you tell them about the roofscape image found in the holoprojector?"
Tien asked. "There was no point. They might have been hoping to assault the Supreme Chancellor's hovercade from the roof. But I think they were simply there to distract us. That's what Cole and Havoc have been doing from the start."
"Then we have nothing more to go on,"
Adi said. "Only that the rest of Havoc's assassins are somewhere in this hall." Obi-Wan, who had been standing quietly throughout the exchange, noticed a familiar look come into Qui-Gon's eye. It was as if Qui-Gon's gaze was fixed on some invisible presence the living force had highlighted.
"What is it, Master?"
he asked quietly.
"I can feel him, Padawan." "Who, Havoc?"
"No, Cole." The tiny, dingy booth assigned to the Eriadu Free Holodaily consisted of a couple of rigid chairs, a control console of dust-covered flat-screen displays and holoprojector pads, and a large single-pane window that looked out on the hall. Havoc stood by the window, staring down at the mostly seated crowd, while he mounted a holocam in its stand. Behind him, and armed with blasters they had secreted in the summit hall weeks earlier, sat two of his human confederates. One of them wore a wrist comm. When Havoc had trained the holocam on the Trade Federation's arc of seats, he attached a scanner to the cam head. Then he aimed the device, which resembled a directional microphone, toward the trumpeters on the floor of the hall. "Any word from the spotter team?" he asked over his shoulder. "Not a chirp," the man with the comlink replied. "And Valorum has been here for over 10 minutes. What do you think happened?"
The likely explanation is that they were discovered. Why do you say that?
Havoc turned to face the pair.
Because I notified the authorities about Cole's freighter, and left the holoprojector behind to be found.
He waited for smiles of revelation, but when none appeared, he added, It was the only way to ensure that the authorities would be kept occupied while we went about our business here.
Then Cole has also been found, or his corpse at any rate, the one with the comlink said.
The other man looked doubtful.
Suppose, as you say, the spotters have been found out, and they decide to cut a deal by telling what they know. Credits or no credits?
Havoc shrugged theatrically.
They know me as Havoc, and no Havoc has been cleared by security to attend the summit. The credit transfers to Cole's hired hands can't be traced directly to us. The safe house will be empty by the time they lead the authorities to it. We'll be long gone from Eriadu before anyone is able to assemble all the pieces of the puzzle.
Clearly meant to restore confidence, Havoc's discourse failed to have the intended effect. If anything, the two men looked even more skeptical than before.
Is our shooter in place?
Havoc asked impatiently.
Out on the walkway, just waiting for the music to begin.
What do you want us to do with him afterward? The one with the comlink asked. Havoc considered it.
He's a misfit with a counterfeit identity badge and a blaster who was just fired at the delegates. You'll be a public hero if you kill him, or at least see to it that he falls from the walkway.
No loose ends, the same one said.
As few as possible.
Back on his alloy crutches, but still wearing a small flag fastened to the front of his robe that identified him as a veteran of the Stark hyperspace conflict, Cole hobbled from the turbolift that had carried him and Boyne to the hall's main pedestrian level. From here, it was possible to ascend to the perimeter walkways that accessed the media and security booths in the upper reaches of the domed building. They were headed for the array of lifts when a voice called out behind them.
Captain Cole!
Cole didn't stop until the stranger repeated the call, then he maneuvered himself through a resigned turn. 10 meters down the corridor stood a tall, long-haired and bearded Jedi, displaying a green-bladed lightsaber.
This just isn't our day, Boyne muttered.
Cole heard the characteristic snap and hiss of another lightsaber and glanced over his shoulder. The second Jedi was a clean-shaven young man, wearing the thin braid of a Padawan.
We've been looking forward to meeting you since Dorvala, the older one said.
Cole and Boyne swapped looks of surprised dismay.
You are the ones in the diplomatic lancet, Cole said. You led us a merry chase, Captain.
Cole snorted and shook his head.
Well, you found us now, and you can put your glow sticks away. We're unarmed.
Qui-Gon merely pointed the lightsaber toward the floor as he approached.
I congratulate you on surviving the destruction of the revenue.
Cole sagged on his crutches.
A lot of good it did me, Jedi. My partner and I are shot to pieces.
Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan regarded them through the Force and understood that Cole wasn't lying. Both he and the Rodian were seriously injured.
How did you find out about the Dorvala operation anyway? Cole asked.
A member of the Nebula Front, Qui-Gon said. Now dead.
So there was an informant. I guess Havoc was right to have been secretive about this one.
We're eager to meet Havoc as well, Obi-Wan said.
Cole looked at him.
You'd do better to destroy the droid Havoc infiltrated into the summit.
Droid?
The Jedi said in unison.
A battle droid, Cole elaborated. It's right up there with the rest of the Directorate's droids.
We figure Havoc plans to have the droid kill Valorum.
That's impossible, Qui-Gon said. Battle droids can't act without a cue from a central control computer.
Havoc's is one of Bactoid's new and improved models, Boyne said. A commander. More of a freethinker. It only needs to be tasked by voice command or remote signal, and it's capable of swaying the droids around it.
Obi-Wan's jaw dropped slightly.
Are you saying that instead of one assassin, there are a potential dozen?
13, actually, Boyne replied.
It still can't initiate an act like that on its own, Qui-Gon insisted.
That's where Havoc comes in. He's the one with the remote.
Qui-Gon stepped toward Cole. Where is he?
I have some idea. Tell me what you know and let me handle this. Obi-Wan will escort you and your partner to medical attention and into custody.
Cole shook his head.
If you want Havoc, we go together, Jedi, or not at all.
He canted his head to Boyne. Besides, we're the only ones who can identify him. Qui-Gon didn't even have to think about it. He glanced at Obi-Wan. Padawan, report back to Master Tian and the others, quickly.
But, Master, go,
Padawan. Now. Obi-Wan showed him a tight-lipped nod and spun on his boot heels. Qui-Gon watched his apprentice rush off, then he deactivated his lightsaber and put one arm under Cole's trembling shoulder. Lean on me, Captain. With drummers setting the tempo, twice as many horn players raised their long instruments to their mouths and trumpeted the first of the three prolonged fanfares. By then, Obi-Wan had reached Tian and the other Jedi. It's the droids, he began in a sally of words. Position yourselves as close to Valorum as possible, he instructed Adi and Vergere. Obi-Wan, Ki, and I will be near the Trade Federation rostrum. The rest of you disperse to deflect blaster fire. Be unassuming but prepared. Master Tian, do you think the Trade Federation suspects what's in their midst? Obi-Wan asked as they set out across the floor of the hall. They couldn't. They are aggressive only when it comes to commerce. However this havoc infiltrated the droid among the others, it had to have been done without the knowledge of the Directorate members. Should we order the delegation to remove the droids, Master? Ki-Adi Mundi replied to it. Whoever is watching may decide to trigger the droids into action. If that happens, it could appear that we posed a threat, prompting the droids to respond with blaster fire. If there was time, we could get someone aboard the Trade Federation freighter to shut down the central control computer. Have you fought these droids before, Master Tian? I know only that they're not very accurate, Padawan. Obi-Wan frowned as he ran. With 13 of them firing, that may not matter. Not even a quarter of the way around the upper-level corridor that accessed the media booths, Boyne spied havoc through a small, transparent steel panel set high in the door. Leaving Cole to stand on his own, Qui-Gon pressed his back to the corridor wall. How many of them are in there? He asked the Rodian.
Havoc, and maybe two other humans, seated to the right of the door.
Qui-Gon nodded to the door release lever. Try it. Gingerly, Boyne placed his hand on the lever.
Locked.
He glanced at the touchpad mounted on the wall.
I can probably slice.
I have a quicker way, Qui-Gon interrupted. Activating his lightsaber, he shoved the glowing blade through the lock mechanism. The metal glowed red and instantly began to slag, tainting the air with biting odors. With a grating sound, the door slid into its wall pocket. By then, Havoc and his two confederates were on their feet, weapons in hand. A flurry of blaster bolts glanced from Qui-Gon's blade, which he held upraised and threw left and right in precise parries. The deflected bolts blazed around the room. Two of them wounded Havoc's men, knocking them to the floor. Undiluted terror fumbled the blaster from Havoc's grip. As it fell, Qui-Gon called the weapon to him with a force summons and tucked it into the wide belt that cinched his tunic. Havoc dropped back into his seat at the console, cowering in fear and raising his shaking hands above his head. Boyne and Cole followed Qui-Gon into the booth. Cole took stock of the situation and looked at Qui-Gon. I'm glad I never had to go up against you people.
Cole,
Havoc said in genuine amazement. Cole made his eyes narrow. Next time you'll know better, amateur. Where is the remote that controls the battle droid? Qui-Gon asked Havoc. Havoc adopted a look of innocent perplexity.
Remote? I don't know what you're talking about.
Qui-Gon towered over him. You infiltrated a droid into those the Trade Federation Directorate brought with them. He reached down and picked Havoc out of his chair, holding him up against the booth's fixed window. Where is the remote? Havoc clutched vainly at Qui-Gon's hand.
Enough! Put me down and I'll tell you!
Qui-Gon lowered him to the chair.
Our shooter has it,
he said, biting out the words. I know the one he means, Cole said. A sniper. Qui-Gon looked back at Havoc. Where is he?
Out on the walkways,
Havoc mumbled, averting his eyes. Qui-Gon glanced at Cole, making up his mind about something. Are you well enough to remain with these three while your partner and I locate the shooter? Cole lowered himself into one of the chairs. I think I can find it in me. The trumpeters had begun the second modulating fanfare,
when a human page approached the Trade Federation rostrum and asked for Viceroy Gunray. The Kuati chair of the delegation directed the page to the far end of the directorate's curved table. With palpable apprehension, Gunray watched the page advance. "I'm sorry to intrude, Viceroy," the human began in Basic, "but apparently there is some problem with your shuttle. Eriadu Spaceport Control needs to speak with you at once." Gunray made his face long and stuck out his already prominent lower jaw.
"Can't this wait until after the summit concludes?"
The page shook his head.
"I apologize, Viceroy, but this is a security matter. I assure you it will only require a moment of your time."
The Kuati chair, who had been monitoring the conversation, swung to face Gunray.
"Go attend to the matter. If luck is with you, you won't have to endure Supreme Chancellor Valorum's opening remarks."
Lot Dodd came to his feet as Gunray was preparing to leave.
"Should I remain in your absence, Viceroy?"
Gunray thought about it for a moment, then shook his head.
"Come with me. You are better at dealing with procedures and legalities than I am. But be quick about it, Senator. I don't wish to miss any more of the summit than I have to."
100 meters above the floor of the summit hall, Qui-Gon and Boyne hurried through the network of walkways, gantries, and trusses that spanned the upper reaches of the building from wall to wall. There were innumerable places where a lone shooter, armed with a remote or a blaster, might conceal himself. Qui-Gon and Boyne hadn't gone far before they encountered the first security agent, who raised a hand weapon as they approached and demanded to know what business they had there. Qui-Gon explained in as few words as possible, at the same time regarding the agent through the Force to determine if his demeanor of righteous authority was genuine. Disconcerted by Qui-Gon's revelations, the agent activated his comlink and notified every agent in the vicinity to recheck the documents of anyone in the walkways, whether their badges identified them as fellow agents or technicians. In the same breath, he ordered that all exits leading to the periphery corridor behind the media booths be sealed off. Within moments, Qui-Gon, Boyne, and the agent were joined by additional security personnel. Forming up into three groups, they fanned out into the walkways. Qui-Gon and Boyne angled away from the perimeter and out over the floor of the hall. Directly below them stood the two lines of trumpeters and drummers. They reached another intersection and split up. His lightsaber casting a faint green light, Qui-Gon stretched out with his feelings and moved warily toward the next balcony. A security agent rushed into view, a blaster rifle cradled in his arms.
"I received word over the comlink," the agent said. "There are two technicians on the next balcony. I suggest we start with them."
The agent stepped aside to let Qui-Gon pass. Qui-Gon sprinted forward, but the Force drew him up short. He began to turn.
Someone shouted, "Jedi!"
Qui-Gon spun and saw Boyne running full out toward him. The security agent was between them, the blaster rifle still angled across his chest. Boyne pointed to the agent.
"That's..."
The agent glanced at Qui-Gon. "He's with me," Qui-Gon started to say. The agent crouched and fired, hitting Boyne square in the chest and hurling him backwards on the walkway. Then he whirled on Qui-Gon, firing steadily. Qui-Gon unleashed his lightsaber, but the blaster bolts were delivered with such speed and precision that he was hard-pressed to deflect all of them. Two whizzed past his blade, raising his left arm and right leg. He stumbled slightly. Drawn by the sounds of the blaster fire, a trio of agents raced into view from the same direction Boyne had come. Havoc's shooter drew a second weapon from a shoulder holster and unloaded on the agents, wounding two of them. Qui-Gon changed the cant of his blade to deflect bolts off to each side rather than back at the shooter, for fear of hitting any of the reinforcements. By now, the agents were returning fire, but showing little concern for Qui-Gon's predicament. Qui-Gon leapt forward. Slashing horizontally with his blade, he severed two of the walkway's tubular vertical supports. Then he slashed downward to rend the struts that braced the platform. Abruptly, both sections of the cleaved walkway tilted, sending Qui-Gon and Havoc's shooters staggering toward each other and the increasing gap between the now dangling ends of the platform. A crazed yell tore from the shooter's throat. He slipped to the floor and began to slide along the grating, firing both weapons at Qui-Gon as he fell. Into the brief silence the musicians inserted between the second and final fanfares came a rush of voices raised in panic. Seated stiffly at the center of the Coruscant delegation's rostrum,
Valorum wasn't sure what had provoked the panic until he saw Sae Terria, with one hand pressed to her mouth, pointing toward the hall ceiling. In the maze of walkways below the dome's oculus window, blaster bolts darted and crisscrossed in the tinted light. Sparks showered down on the drummers and trumpeters like a benediction. Then, a figure plummeted from one of the walkways. Sae screamed. From the Trade Federation's side of the hall, the chair of the Directorate watched open-mouthed as a blaster fight erupted in the overhead trusses and gantries. On the floor, at the same time, three Jedi and several Judicials were moving quickly, if surreptitiously, toward the Directorate rostrum. The Kuati glanced between the ceiling and floor. Had the summit been engineered to trap the Directorate, he asked himself. Would the Republic be so bold as to attack them in public? The security droids had gone from standing at attention to postures of readiness, crouching slightly, with arms crooked and left legs extended behind. They were programmed to answer to any or all of the Directorate members, or at least relay a Directorate member's commands to the central control computer on board the Trade Federation vessel. But the droids responded best to the Nemoidians. The Kuati chair looked around for Viceroy Gunray and realized that he hadn't returned. At a loss for what to do, he swung to one of his aides. "Activate the force field," he ordered. The sounds of blasters and panic on the floor infiltrated the media booth Havoc had secured. Seated in a chair with a hand weapon leveled at Havoc, Cole heard the holocam click on and saw Havoc glance at it. "Am I correct in assuming that you intend to kill me?" Havoc asked. "Killing is what you are good at, after all." "You're doing pretty good for a beginner, Havoc." Havoc snorted in disdain. "I'm prepared to die for the cause, Captain." "Maybe you are," Cole said. "But I'm not going to give you that privilege. You're going to die for killing Rella. Besides, your cause is lost." Havoc glanced at the holocam again. "You think so?" Cole gestured toward the transparasteel window. "You hear those blaster bolts? The Jedi found your shooter, the one controlling the droid. Valorum is out of danger. I never thought much of the plan anyway, seeing how Valorum is trying to dismantle the Federation the same as you are." Havoc laughed shortly. "You failed to see the truth, Cole. You really are too old for the game. What makes you think that we were ever after Valorum?" Cole's grin straightened. Grimacing in pain, he pushed himself out of the chair and limped to the window. The blaster fight had thrown the hall into utter chaos. The members of the Trade Federation Directorate were standing behind their curved table, surrounded by their security droids, everyone safe inside a shimmering force field. Off to one side, a group of Jedi and Judicials were closing on the Federation's rostrum. Cole swung to Havoc, his eyes blazing. "You're after the Trade Federation!" Havoc couldn't restrain a triumphant smile. "It was just a matter of getting them to activate the force field." He indicated the devices that were aimed down at the hall. "The scanner detected the activation. The holocam is going to do the rest." "The remote," Cole said, as if in a daze. He lunged for the cam, meeting Havoc halfway. They slammed into each other and fell grappling to the floor of the booth. They rolled toward the door, each man fighting for superiority, the blaster between them in the clutch of four hands. Cole swung his elbow into Havoc's face, knocking him sideways, then used Havoc's momentum to pitch himself on top of Havoc, pinning him to the floor with his knees. Havoc squirmed, but held tightly to the blaster, triggering a bolt into Cole's abdomen. Cole fell partially back, then slumped forward, bringing all his weight to bear on the weapon and forcing it down into Havoc's chest. With what little of his strength remained, Cole squeezed out a final bolt. Dangling by one hand from the swaying walkway, Qui-Gon looked down at the floor of the hall. The trumpeters had stopped mid-fanfare and were scattering for cover, abandoning their horns as they ran. Everywhere else, delegates were fleeing their seats, literally climbing over one another in a desperate attempt to escape. Valorum was on his feet, but completely encircled by Senate guards. Sae-Sitin, Ki-Adi-Mundi, and Obi-Wan had taken up positions in front of the Trade Federation rostrum, their lightsabers lifted to deflect fire from the droids. But the Directorate members had raised their force field, which meant that no bolts could enter or leave the translucent shield.
The 13 droids reached over their right shoulders for the blaster rifles secured to their backpacks. Then, all at once, the droids pivoted through an about-face. The members of the Directorate mouthed commands and curses and began to back away from the curved table. The droids fired. As the Jedi and Judicials watched helplessly, bolts tore into the table and chairs and into the flesh of the members, shaking them about and hurling them to all sides of the rostrum. The firing ceased as abruptly as it had started. For a moment, the droids stood with their cooling blasters, then they put them back over their shoulders and turned to face the hall. Stunned by what he had witnessed, Qui-Gon clambered onto the shaky walkway and dropped cross-legged to the slanted floor, staring off into space.
"The Nebula Front has largely disbanded," the judicial officer explained to Qui-Gon. "The few we've been able to track down contend that they knew nothing about Havoc's plans for Eriadu."
"The informant was one of the moderates," Qui-Gon amended. "It was through him that I learned about Cole's designs to raid the Trade Federation freighter at Dorvala, and on Asmeru about a clandestine operation Cole was executing for Havoc." The judicial, a thin, brown-haired woman with a personable manner, made note of Qui-Gon's remarks on a desktop datapad. It was just the two of them in a small cubicle in the Justice Department's cavernous headquarters on Coruscant. Almost a standard month had gone by since the assassinations. Deactivating the shield the members of the Trade Federation Directorate had thrown about themselves, unknowingly ushering in their own demise, had required a team of technicians using a pair of field disruptors. The two Nemoidians who had survived the massacre, Viceroy Newt Gunray and Senator Lot Dodd, had not protested when the same disruptors had been employed to dazzle the 13 droids into states of guaranteed submission. Diplomatic privilege had permitted the Nemoidians to depart Eriadu without answering any questions. Supreme Chancellor Valorum had ordered the Justice Department to commence an immediate investigation, but the chief investigators had soon found themselves thwarted by Lieutenant Governor Tarkin. Tarkin insisted that since Eriadu had failed to provide adequate security, the case should be handled by Eriaduan investigators. There was some concern that Tarkin, fearing retaliation by the Trade Federation, would seek to shift the blame to other parties. But instead, he had simply impeded the investigation by allowing evidence and eyewitnesses to vanish. Ignored, the judicials Valorum had asked to remain behind on Eriadu had finally decamped. Qui-Gon had tried to stay abreast of developments in the case, but the chief investigator who served as liaison with the Eriaduan team had only just returned to Coruscant.
"Havoc turns out to have been Eriaduan," the judicial officer continued. "His real name was Bruma Talus, a media correspondent and holodocumentarian, with a long-standing grudge against the Trade Federation. At some point he became the leader of the Nebula Front cell on Eriadu and rose through the ranks to a command in the organization."
"The operation must have been planned as soon as the Trade Summit was announced," Qui-Gon said, "or soon after the attack on the Supreme Chancellor here on Coruscant. I don't suppose we'll ever know whether that attack was genuine or designed from the start to sidetrack us from what was being set in motion on Eriadu."
"Not unless Cole or Havoc learns to speak from beyond the grave," the judicial said.
"What of the assassins who were captured?"
"Everyone in custody upholds that Valorum was the target, even the two who you discovered with Havoc in the media booth. As they tell it, Havoc's goal was to make it appear that Trade Federation droids had killed Valorum at the behest of the Directorate. That would have led to the dismantling of the Federation, which is what the Nebula Front wanted all along. We considered the possibility that something went wrong with the droid's programming, and that the attack on the Directorate was a mistake. But Bactoid provided ample proof that that could not have happened."
"Could Bactoid have been involved in abetting Havoc?"
"They vehemently deny any involvement. In fact, their technicians helped us analyze the battle droid, the so-called Commander, which was found to contain a mechanism that allowed it to be controlled independently of the central control computer, but only for a brief period. Havoc's holocam prompted the Commander to act, and the 12 other droids followed the Commander's lead. As soon as the central control computer realized what was occurring in the summit hall, it shut down all of them."
Qui-Gon considered it for a moment. "Havoc must have had help getting the droid into Trade Federation hands."
"Absolutely," the judicial said, nodding. "But diplomatic privilege has prevented us from learning all that we wish to know."
What about the message that took Gunray and Dodd from the summit hall?
Legitimate, as far as can be determined. A plasma leak was detected in the engines of the Nemoidian's shuttle. The leak touched off scanners at the spaceport, and someone at the spaceport contacted security at the summit hall. The problem is, we haven't been able to learn the identity of whoever it was that contacted security. Viceroy Gunray insists that the comlink the page led him to was inactive when he reached it. The page has verified this. By the time Gunray and Dodd were headed back to their seats, the violence had already broken out, and security agents restrained them from re-entering the hall.
The judicial shook her head in exasperation.
It all comes down to havoc.
Qui-Gon folded his arms across his chest and nodded, though not convincingly.
So it would appear.
It's a pleasure to see you again, Senator Palpatine,
the exquisite figure in the holoprojector field said.
I look forward to the day when we can meet again in person.
I do as well, Your Majesty, Palpatine said, bowing his head in a gesture of respect. The figure sat in a round-backed throne, with a towering arch-topped window at her back, and to either side, massive columns of native stone. Her low voice was as composed as her posture. The words emerged from her painted lips with scant inflection. She had a slight boyish figure and a lovely feminine face. She was remarkably solemn for one so young. It was clear that she took her responsibilities with the utmost seriousness. Her birth name was Padme Naberi, but she would henceforth be known as Queen Amidala, the newly elected ruler of Naboo. Palpatine was receiving the communication in his apartment, high in the crag-like tower that was in one of Coruscant's oldest and most prestigious precincts. The walls and floor were as red as Amidala's throne, with objects of art adorning every niche and corner.
Senator, I wanted to advise you about something which has only now been revealed to me. King Varuna is dead.
Dead, Your Majesty? Palpatine frowned in apparent disquiet. Of course, I was aware that he had gone into hiding following his abdication, but I understood that he was in good health.
He was in good health, Senator,
Amidala said in a low monotone.
His death has been ruled accidental, but much mystery surrounds it.
Even at 14 years of age, she was not the youngest monarch ever elected to the throne, but she was certainly one of the most conventional in dress and bearing. She was sheathed head to foot in a wide-shouldered red gown, whose ample cuffs were trimmed with patali fur. The gown's narrow bib was embroidered in priceless thread. Painted white, her face sat in the notch of a deep collar that not only bracketed her fine features, but also became part of an elaborate jeweled headpiece that flared behind her head. Her thumbnails were accented with white polish, and each cheekbone with a red stylized beauty mark. A traditional scar of remembrance bisected her lower lip, which, unlike its red mate, was also painted white. Five handmaidens stood behind her, dressed in hooded burgundy gowns.
I wish you to meet our new chief of security, Senator,
Amidala said, gesturing to someone out of view.
Captain Panaka.
A clean-shaven man with light brown skin moved into the hollow field. Humorless looking, he was dressed in a leather jerkin and matching command cap. Panaka may have been recently appointed, but he was not new to the court, since Panaka had served for a time under his predecessor, Captain Magneta.
Because King Varuna died under suspicious circumstances,
Amidala said,
Captain Panaka feels that additional security is required for all of us, including you, Senator.
Palpatine looked surprised, even entertained by the notion. I hardly think that's necessary on Coruscant, Your Majesty. The only danger here comes from having to fraternize with other senators and somehow remain immune to the greed that plagues the Galactic Senate.
What about the recent troubles between the Trade Federation and the Nebula Front terrorists, Senator?
The Queen asked. Palpatine shook his head in disapproval. That sorry incident only pointed out how ineffectual the Republic has become at mediating such conflicts. Too many in the Senate place their own needs above the needs of the Republic.
What will become of Chancellor Valorum's proposal to tax the free trade zones?
I feel certain that the Supreme Chancellor will pursue the matter.
How will you vote, Senator, should the matter reach a vote?
How would you have me vote, Your Majesty? Amidala thought before replying.
My responsibility is to the people of Naboo. I would very much like to establish good relations with Chancellor Valorum, But Naboo can scarcely afford to become embroiled in a dispute that pits the Republic against the Trade Federation. I will abide by your decision on the matter, Senator.
Palpatine inclined his head. Then I will weigh the matter carefully and vote according to what is ultimately best for Naboo and the Republic. Valorum stood at the tall windows, gazing out on the cityscape. The last time we met here, it was to discuss the Trade Federation's request for protection from terrorists, he said. And in the months since, the situation has only intensified. When I reflect on the sequence of events that have brought us to this dark place, I find myself at a loss. If someone had tried to tell me months ago that we were headed here, I wouldn't have heeded the warning because I wouldn't have considered it possible. Senator Palpatine said nothing. He waited for Valorum to turn from the view. Out of respect for what occurred at the summit, I have deferred in bringing the motion for taxation before the Senate. But I am under pressure to resolve the matter once and for all, from those who support it, as well as those who oppose it. Valorum pivoted to face Palpatine. You, perhaps more than anyone, know the climate of the Senate. Did the assassinations create sympathy for the Trade Federation? To the point where we won't be able to gather sufficient support for taxation? On the contrary, Palpatine said. What happened on Eriadu only reinforced everyone's fears that we are entering violent times, and that the conflict between the Trade Federation and the Nebula Front could be a sign of greater tragedies to come. What's more, with the profit-driven Nemoidians now helming the Trade Federation, tension is likely to intensify in the outlying systems. Your plan to redirect revenue to the Outer Rim is praiseworthy, and is something that should be put into effect. Valorum nodded. And what of the Trade Federation's request for additional defenses? Even with the Nebula Front eliminated as a threat, the Nemoidians will want permission to augment their army. That's true, Palpatine said slowly. As an accommodation, if nothing else, we should at least consider allowing the Trade Federation to take whatever steps are necessary to safeguard their vessels. Valorum regarded Palpatine. Will we have Naboo's vote? Palpatine sighed with purpose. Unfortunately, Queen Amidala is not prepared to support taxation, as Naboo still relies on the Trade Federation for many essential imports. She is young and inexperienced in such matters, but eager to learn. He fixed his gaze on Valorum. However, I will continue to do all in my power to work behind the scenes. I feel certain that we will be able to rally the votes needed. Valorum smiled in gratitude. For all the support you have shown me, my friend, I trust that you will take on faith that, should need ever arise, I would do all within my power to render aid to Naboo. Thank you, Supreme Chancellor. As you say, I will take that vow on your word. The public corridors of the Galactic Senate overflowed with Holonet correspondents, well-wishers, and the more civic-minded of Coruscant's citizens. Flanked by Senate guards and his personal aide, Sei Terrier, a rejuvenated Valorum moved slowly through the principal corridor, trading dignified nods with senators and ignoring questions hurled by the media reporters. Supreme Chancellor, did you ever for a moment doubt that the taxation proposal would be ratified? A Twi'lek correspondent asked. Sei Terrier answered for him. The issue has been controversial from the start, but everyone involved remained confident that the proposal would pass once all parties had an opportunity to be heard. An attractive human female shouldered her way to the front of the crowd. Considering what happened at the trade summit, do you still feel that all parties were heard? Terrier held up her hands. Later today, the Office of the Supreme Chancellor will issue a statement. Until that time, there will be no further questions. The correspondents grumbled, but ultimately fell silent and stepped aside, as Valorum's contingent of advisors and guards steered him toward the turbolift that accessed his private chambers. Once there, he removed his outer cloak, sat heavily into his chair, and loosed a prolonged exhale. Thank you for running interference, he told Terrier when the two of them were alone in the office. She smiled and took a seat opposite him. We should issue a statement as quickly as possible. Do you want to compose something now? Valorum frowned, then got to his feet and walked to the center of the room, his hands clasped behind his back. Terrier activated the record function of her wrist comlink.
For too long a time, the Senate has been bogged down by policies and procedures, Valorum began after a moment, but today we managed to sidestep that bureaucratic morass. We have succeeded in overcoming our inertia by setting aside petty squabbles and self-interest, and by banding together to strike a blow for the Republic itself. In this, we have reaffirmed our mandate and refound our way. Valorum cut short his remarks when a tone issued from the office door. When Sei Terria opened the door, two Senate guards conducted Alderanian Senator Bale Antilles into the room. In his right hand, the chair of the Internal Activities Committee held a legal-looking piece of durasheet. Supreme Chancellor, I'm sorry to have to be the bearer of raw tidings on a day that should be devoted to celebration, Antilles said, extending the durasheet to Valorum. But this document constitutes official notification that you are hereby requested to appear before the Supreme Court to answer allegations of corruption and illegal enrichment. Valorum blinked in stupefaction. He couldn't make sense of what he had just heard. This had to be a mistake, or a joke in very poor taste. His heart thudded against his breastbone, and he grew short of breath. He stared at the durasheet he had accepted, then glared at Antilles. I demand to know the meaning of this. Antilles compressed his lips. Again, I apologize, Supreme Chancellor, but that is all I am permitted to say about the matter at this time. Valorum was surrounded not by Senate guards, but by lawyers when he finally appeared before the Supreme Court almost 2 weeks later. During that time, his legal team had managed to discover that the basis for the allegations was an investment made to Valorum Shipping, an Ariadu. Beyond that, Valorum was in the dark. Valorum and his lawyers were seated at a long table opposite the 12 robed figures who comprised the Judiciary Council. Bale Antilles and the members of the Domestic Activities Committee sat perpendicular to the bench. The Chief Justice spoke, addressing Valorum. Supreme Chancellor, we appreciate that you elected to appear before us without being subpoenaed by writ. We are given to understand that this is an informal inquest, one of the lawyers said in Valorum's stead. Your presumption is correct. The judge looked to Antilles, who stood and spoke from his place at the committee's table. Your Honors, Supreme Chancellor Valorum, he began. Just 2 weeks ago, the Senate met in special session to vote on a motion introduced by Supreme Chancellor Valorum, calling for a tax to be levied on all shipping and other mercantile activities in what were formerly known as the free trade zones of the outlying systems. An amendment to the original proposal directed that a percentage of all revenues collected by the Republic would be redistributed among the outlying systems for purposes of social welfare and technological advancement. Many business concerns located in those systems have already begun to reap the benefits of the amendment in the form of venture capital bestowed by investors here in the core. One of those concerns is Valorum Shipping and Transport, the Ariadu, which has received an enormous sum for a company that has shown only marginal profits over the past several standard years. Valorum's lawyer interrupted. With all due respect, Senator Antilles, Supreme Chancellor Valorum was not made aware of the investment to Valorum Shipping until last week. Regardless, while it's true that the company bears the Valorum name and that the Supreme Chancellor is a member of the Board of Directors, he does not participate in company operations or involve himself with each and every commonplace business transaction. Furthermore, the Supreme Chancellor, as required by law, has made full disclosure of all his holdings, and his record with regard to earnings and taxes is spotless. The 12 judges looked at Antilles, who was still frowning when the lawyer finished speaking. If I may be allowed to continue, the Internal Activities Committee does not take issue with any of the statements made by the Supreme Chancellor's legal representative. In fact, when this matter was first brought to our attention, we proceeded under the assumption that no infringement of protocol had occurred. However, Antilles let the word dangle for a long moment before continuing. Subsequent investigation has shown that the contribution to Valorum Shipping did not originate with a consortium or venture capital group. Rather, the revenue was drawn from a blind account and moved to Ariadu through a Coruscant bank of dubious reputation. I used the term moved advisedly, Your Honors, since the investment was tendered in the form of hard assets. Valorum's lawyers regarded one another in puzzlement. Of what sort? The spokesman asked Antilles. Orodium ingots. Blood drained from Valorum's face, and a stir went through the room. Valorum and his lawyers conferred for a moment before the spokesman replied.
Your Honors, we acknowledge that the investment begins to sound, shall we say, less than forthright. Nevertheless, Senator Antilles has yet to demonstrate exactly how this matter relates to the Supreme Chancellor.
Antilles' expression made clear that he had been waiting for just this moment. He gazed at Valorum while he delivered his finishing stroke. What the Internal Activities Committee finds most interesting and questionable is that the value of the Orodium, and indeed the quantity, corresponds exactly to a cache of ingots reported missing by the Trade Federation following an attack on one of their vessels, the Revenue, in the Dorvala system, several months ago. Hushed conversations erupted throughout the room as Antilles stepped out from behind the table and approached the bench.
Your Honors, this is not an indictment. The committee merely wishes to be reassured that the Supreme Chancellor did not have a hidden agenda in supporting taxation as part of a scheme to enrich his own holdings in the outlying systems. The committee also wishes to be reassured that the Orodium in question did, in fact, disappear from the Revenue and was not simply transferred to Valorum Shipping to seal a clandestine partnership existing between the Supreme Chancellor and the Trade Federation.
Senator Palpatine was one of 100 or more senators who had been invited to Orne Freetah's lavish penthouse for an evening of exceptional food and extravagant drink. What had been touted as an occasion, however, had all the undercurrents of a conclave, and where outsiders assumed that its purpose was to celebrate Valorum's seeming victory in the Senate, it was instead intended to cheer his recent reversal of fortune. On the largest of the penthouse's many terraces, the blue-skinned Twi'lek host was holding forth for an audience of senators who hung on his every word.
Of course we knew about the alleged improprieties, but it was necessary to delay mention of the scandal to ensure that the tax proposal would be ratified, which wouldn't have been the case had Valorum been weakened beforehand.
Ta shook his head and Fat Leku.
No. By waiting to reveal the allegations and by supporting Valorum, we managed to turn what might have been perceived as an instance of ordinary corruption into what hints at a nefarious plot that threatens the stability of the very Republic.
But is there actually anything to the accusations? Foreign Senator Tikus asked, his facial tentacles quivering in prospect.
Ta's enormous shoulders heaved in a shrug of indifference.
There is the Orodium, and there is the appearance of deceit. What else matters?
If it is true, then Valorum has become a danger to the general good, a senator remarked.
Tikus affirmed it with an enthusiastic nod.
I say we shake him, before worse days endure.
Others nodded in agreement, muttering among themselves.
Patience, patience, Ta advised in a soothing voice. Baseless or not, the allegations have essentially crippled Valorum. We need only to rid ourselves of those senators who have buoyed him in the past, enabling him to remain afloat despite our best attempts to sink him. Besides, there may yet be some advantage to keeping him high and dry.
What advantage?
The senator from Rhodia asked.
With his influence further eroded, and the Justice Department stripped of some of its former authority, commissions will have to be appointed to render judgments and decisions he would ordinarily make. The power of the courts will increase, but cases will invariably take longer than ever to resolve. And yet, Valorum will continue to suffer the blame.
Unless a strong vice-chancellor is appointed, the Rhodian thought to point out.
We must not let that happen, Ta said firmly. We need a consummate bureaucrat to serve as vice-chancellor.
Ta noticed Palpatine standing by the terrace doors, engaged in deep conversation with the senators from Fondor and Eriadu.
I propose that we consider nominating Palpatine, he said, gesturing discreetly.
Tikus and the rest glanced at the tall senator from Naboo.
Palpatine would never accept the nomination, the Quarren said. He considers himself a supporting player.
Ta narrowed his eyes.
Then we must convince him. Think what it would mean to the outlying systems if someone from other than a core world was elected Supreme Chancellor. There might finally be equality for all species. He can restore order if anyone can. He has the right combination of selflessness and quiet power. And don't let yourselves be fooled.
There is a strong hand concealed within those loose sleeves. He cares deeply about the integrity of the Republic, and he will do whatever is needed to enforce the laws.
Tychus was dubious. Then we will not be able to play him as we have Valorum.
That's the beauty of it, Tar said. We won't have to, because he thinks like one of us.
In all the years she had known him, Adi Gallia had never seen Valorum so despondent. He could be moody at times and unjustly hard on himself, but the allegations of corruption had tipped him into a dark place from which he could not surface. In the months since she had seen him last, he appeared to have aged a year. "The Orodium was the Nebula Front's final stab at me," he was telling her. "The terrorists were determined to take me down, along with the Trade Federation Directorate. Although I ask myself if certain senators weren't involved, those who would sooner see me disgraced than simply disempowered."
"It will only be a matter of time before you are exonerated," Adi tried to reassure him.
Valorum scarcely heard her.
"I don't care what they say about me personally. But now, all that I have accomplished in the Senate is in question. I am made to answer to Masa Meda, who is so consumed with procedure that no new legislation will pass. Yet more commissions and committees will come into being, and with them expanded opportunities for graft and corruption."
Valorum fell quiet for a long moment, shaking his head back and forth. "The assassinations on Eriadu, and now this scandal, will have wide-ranging consequences. It has already been made clear to me that the Jedi are not to become involved in trade disputes without the express consent of the Senate. But worst of all is the disservice I have done the Republic."
He put his elbows on the desk and pressed his fingertips to his temples, keeping his gaze downward. "I had a terrible dream last night that seemed as much a reflection of my present circumstance as a vision of the future. In it, I felt myself besieged by nebulous forces, by wraiths of one sort or another. Something was reaching for me out of the blackness to crush me in its grip."
"Terrible, but only a dream," Adi said. "Not a vision."
Valorum managed to summon the same weak smile when he looked up at her. "If only I had more supporters like you and Senator Palpatine."
"Better a few faithful supporters than a wealth of false friends," Adi said. "Perhaps you can find some solace in that."
In the High Council Tower of the Jedi Temple, the Council members listened to Adi recount her meeting with Valorum. As ever, Yoda was in motion, walking about with his gimmer-stick cane, and, because of the part they had played in the events, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan were present. "The Supreme Chancellor is correct about one thing," Mace Windu said. "The Orodium could only have come from Havoc. Cole delivered the stolen ingots to him, then Havoc set up the blind account and saw to it that the Orodium was invested in Valorum shipping."
"But why?" Yeriel Poof asked.
"By suggesting collusion, Havoc hoped to bring down both the Supreme Chancellor and the Trade Federation."
"Valorum, perhaps," Depa Balaba said. "But the Nemoidians have much of the Senate on their payroll. The Trade Federation hasn't been touched by the scandal."
"Indeed they haven't," Oppo Ranchisus agreed. "Too little thought we gave these events," Yoda said. "All of us."
Yaddle turned to face Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, who were standing outside the Master's Circle.
"You two, flying here, flying there, chasing clues? If stopped for a moment you had to listen to the unifying force, see what was coming you might have."
"I did what I had to do, Masters," Qui-Gon said without apology. Yoda loosed a prolonged sigh.
"Blame you we don't, Qui-Gon, but exasperate us you do."
Qui-Gon inclined his head in a bow.
"This scandal wasn't the sole work of the Nebula Front," Adi said. "The Supreme Chancellor has other enemies, hidden enemies, plotting against him, trying to maneuver him into a position where he will err gravely and be voted out of office or be forced to resign."
"To be replaced by the likes of Bail Antilles or Ainley Teem," Sisi Tian muttered.
Windu nodded. "He has been too trusting."
"Too naive," even Peel remarked harshly.
Yoda paced, then stopped.
"Help him we must, in secret if need be."
"We must heed the will of the Force in this matter," Windu said. "We must be open to ways to counter the treacherous vortex into which the Republic has been drawn. Perhaps we can help Valorum get wind of events before his enemies have an opportunity to stack those events against him."
He senses perilous times ahead, Adi said, as if some darkness has been awakened, intent on spreading itself across the galaxy.
Yaddle broke the long silence.
As prophesied, it has been. Tipping the balance is.
Yoda looked at her.
Tipping, yes, but from troubled times to untroubled, or from bad times to worse?
Windu steepled his fingers in front of his face.
And what unknown hand is doing the tipping?
Darth Sidious visited Newt Gunray and his advisors by hologram on the bridge of the Trade Federation freighter Sakak, known in Basic as the Profiteer.
Congratulations on your promotion, Viceroy,
the Sith Lord rasped in a manner that made derision sound like a compliment.
Thank you, my lord,
Gunray was quick to respond.
We did not imagine, when you said you would convince our competitors in the Directorate, that you would...
That I would what, Viceroy? Perhaps you imagine that I would act with greater subtlety, is that it? Now there is no one to stand in your way of acquiring an army or directing the future course of the Trade Federation.
Hath Monchar, Roon Hakko, and Commander Dorte Dauphine looked at Gunray in stark apprehension.
I meant no offense, my lord, he stammered.
Sidious was briefly quiet. If only they could see his eyes, they might have had a hint of what he was thinking.
Soon, I will be taking steps to eliminate some of your other competitors,
he intoned a moment later.
But that does not concern you. Instead, I want you to devote your energies to becoming familiar with the capabilities of your newly acquired toys. Your battle droids, and droid starfighters, and landing craft. Have Bactoid and Tower Chawl Engineering been filling your orders on schedule?
They have, my lord, Gunray said, though at exorbitant cost.
Don't try my patience with talk of credits, Viceroy,
Sidious warned.
There is more at stake than the health of your financial accounts.
Gunray was close to trembling.
What would you have us do, my lord?
We are going to put your new army to the test.
Gunray and Hath Monchar exchanged fearful glances.
A test? Monchar said.
Sidious seemed to gaze at him for an uncomfortably long time.
Potentially, he said at last. I suspect that you are hardly thrilled by the Senate's sanction of taxation of the trade routes.
Gunray nodded.
The Senate has no right.
Of course not. And what better way to demonstrate your displeasure than through a trade blockade?
Of Eriadu, Gunray said eagerly. Because of what happened?
Eriadu would respond with force, Viceroy. We don't want a war. We want an embargo.
Which world shall it be? Monchar said.
I suggest we strike at the home world of the senator who is most responsible for championing the taxation bill. Naboo.
Naboo? Hakko said in genuine bewilderment. Sidious nodded.
Senator Palpatine is adept at dissembling his real nature. You scarcely realize how much damage he has already caused.
But would such a blockade be legal? Gunray asked. Valorum will never sit still for it.
I have a surprise in store for feeble-tempered Valorum,
Sidious promised.
What's more, the scandal surrounding the Supreme Chancellor has led many senators to rethink the taxation legislation. Few will grumble about a trade embargo of a world so distant from the core.
Monchar stepped forward.
And what of the Jedi?
They are already constrained from interfering.
But if they do, my lord, Gunray said.
We will not be subtle in dealing with them.
Gunray bowed his head.
Once again, we place ourselves in your hands.
Sidious smiled faintly.
As I told you once before, Viceroy, you serve yourselves best. when you serve me.
This is Alexander Adams. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Star Wars, Cloak of Deception by James Luceno. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Charles Potter. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Abridgment by David Smith. Star Wars, Cloak of Deception is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 2001. All rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music master production, copyright 2001, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation. All rights reserved.